ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In the course of my travels, I've been recording nature soundscapes with the aim of helping you, Australia, to relax. And in this particular overnight recording, there was this one duck that just kept screaming its guts out. Anyway, don't worry, I've selected only the best, most relaxing soundscapes that absolutely do not feature this duck. Find Nature Sounds by Anne Jones wherever you get your podcasts and on the ABC Listen app.
Coming to you from NAR Melbourne on ABC Radio National, this is Life Matters. Hello, I'm Beverly Wang. I bet you've got a pretty strong understanding of the importance of protecting your physical health and safety in the workplace. There are plenty of rules and training modules about when to wear safety gear, how to avoid hazards, and maintaining tools and equipment. But what about your psychological health and safety? How do you identify those hazards and design jobs and workplaces that safeguard our mental well-being? If you've ever dealt with work conditions that took a toll on your mental health and well-being, how is that handled either by you or your workplace? How would you like those conditions to improve? And in 40 minutes' time, the aunties debate the ethics of profiting from clothing swaps. Let's talk. Did you know that all across Australia and every state and territory, there are now workplace health and safety laws governing the management of psychological hazards in workplaces? You may not be too familiar with them because they're fairly new, in some jurisdictions less than a year old. What this means is, in the eyes of the law, work conditions that put your mental health and psychological safety at risk are now on equal footing with those that threaten physical health and safety and meant to be taken just as seriously. So here's a short list of some psychosocial hazards. Lack of role clarity. That's unclear understanding of role and responsibilities that causes confusion and frustration. There's also unachievable job demands, low job control, and inadequate reward and recognition. You may be hearing this and nodding along, already identifying parts of your job where this may be happening to you. You're not alone because psychosocial workplace claims are on the rise. And as you're about to hear from my guests, many Australians experience mental distress due to their jobs. So the goal of today is to help you get a better understanding of these new regulations, point you towards further resources, and share your experiences. Helping me out with this conversation, welcome to Mariah Lorienti. Mariah is an employment lawyer and workplace relations consultant. Hi, Mariah.
Hi.
And Andrew Sloan is a psychotherapist who works with individuals and businesses negotiating workplace change. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
Now, Mariah and Andrew are helping me take your calls. Just as a caveat, this is a radio show, not a legal practice or a clinic, so they can offer general advice only. So let's begin with you, Mariah. I've listed a few psychosocial hazards before. Can you help me flesh out that definition?
Yeah. It's really interesting because you have to differentiate psychological safety and a psychosocial hazard. So a psychosocial hazard is essentially systems of work, the way work is designed, your relationships at work, and the environment at work. So they're kind of the four key categories that you're working to. In Australia, there are four main, the biggest psychosocial hazards. You said one of them when you introed, and that was lack of clarity in your position and what's expected of you in your role. That's one of them. The other one I would say is capacity or lack thereof in your position. That's a huge hazard in Australia. The third is perceived fairness at work. And the fourth is lack of change management.
And what, if we can just kind of look at more definitions, what does psychological safety mean?
So psychological safety is the belief that you feel safe at work. You feel safe raising concerns, making mistakes, asking for support without any negative consequences that come with that.
Mariah, I mentioned earlier that these new laws are in effect all around Australia at the moment. I'm curious, why did this process begin? What was the prompt?
Yeah, I think that's probably twofold. I think there was a huge financial driver. And when I say financial, it's money and time. I think the stat is it costs Australia around $14 billion nationally, each year in the economy. That's huge.
Yeah.
And then when you go into micro, and you look at Victoria, for example, the stats for WorkCover claims from a mental health perspective have doubled in the last 10 years. It's only around 12% of serious claims, which doesn't seem like a lot. But when you look at that as in it's doubled, that is huge. And it also takes five times longer to resolve a WorkCover claim relating to mental health than it would a physical hazard.
So why are these laws, how will these laws then affect, you know, the number of claims, the processing of these claims?
Well, I think they're designed to ensure that businesses deal with this before it gets external. Okay. And then I think the other driver for the laws, which is really important to note, is there's been a huge culture shift in how we talk about mental health generally in society. 15 years ago, it was quite taboo to talk about having a toxic workplace, but now it's not. Mm. And I think the pandemic was a huge driver of that. It kind of accelerated the conversation.
Andrew, yeah, I was going to, as you said that, Mariah, I was like, oh, must have been the pandemic. I saw you nodding there. What are your thoughts on this change that Mariah's described?
Well, I think we're facing a fundamental crisis at work. This is a humanitarian crisis, an epic proportions. We spend the majority of our time and our energy in our lives towards work and in workplaces. Gallup actually does research in this, and what we've discovered is that only 25% of workplaces globally have the conditions for psychological and psychosocial safety. This relegates 75% of us into workplaces that are really not fit for our well-being. When I go out into workplaces, I notice that this lack of sort of basic care inside of workplaces is driving these systemic risks. We've got a fundamental crisis and it is really hurting us. Levels of stress, worry, burnout are all at epic proportions. And I think that's being shaped even worse by how fast we're going, how much pressure our workplaces are feeling. This whole AI revolution post-COVID is also really threatening our workplaces. We're dipping into fear. We're not in safety. We can't look at each other in the eyes and have great relationships. And this is really hammering our ability to work well.
Mm. Where are those 25% of workplaces? How can we get there?
Wow, what a question.
I'm being facetious.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I get it. But my clients will ask this question, how do we find them? And it's really hard. And so when we start to continue to have this conversation, I you know, what can we do in a workplace that isn't great is where we might head.
So, Mariah, you mentioned that these laws came into place possibly partially in part to address things before they come to a head. But we already have some existing laws, regulations around safety in the workplace, not just the physical stuff that I mentioned, what kind of equipment you have to keep your body safe. But also, there are already guardrails around bullying, for example. So how do these laws take things even further?
Well, when you think about something like bullying or sexual harassment or gender-based violence, that's kind of, to me, that's they're really serious. It happens all the time. I see it all the time, yes. But it's the smaller scale things that happen every day that would amount to bullying, for example. So I think the laws are really important in putting in place safeguards for the little things that amount to the bigger things.
And in your practice, in your work, how are you seeing the impact of these laws already?
People are taking them seriously, but only to the effect where they think it's going to impact them. So I go into a workplace and I speak to leaders and they say, hey, we have an open door policy. People can talk to us about whatever they like. And you go a little bit deeper and you realise that nobody actually opens that door. So it's about finding out why aren't they opening
the door. And it depends on who you ask as well.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. I have a text here that I'd love to get your thoughts on. The texter says, Beverly, if your job is causing you mental health issues, leave and get a different job. It is not up to your employer to babysit you, leave. You are a liability. Andrew, what's your response to that sentiment?
I think there's times where we do have to leave. Like in any relationship that's not working or is damaging our well-being, we might have to leave. For a lot of the people I meet with every week, where are they going to go right now when 75% of workplaces are challenged? So there's certainly cases to exit and to leave. And, you know, we need to have a plan for that in this economy between work and making sure that we can survive and thrive in the world as it is. there are times where we could do a couple of things that actually might make all the difference. If we can get really clear on what excellence looks like, what great looks like inside of our work, if we can attempt to create a better relationship with our manager, 70% of our well-being and productivity in work is our one-to-one relationship with our boss. Mm. Is there another team in the same organization that you could work with and work for? And are we learning and growing? You know, what's the stretch job that you want to take on to expand? But certainly, I think it is in our power to self-lead when others are refusing to take ownership of leading us.
Well, it's interesting you say that, you know, it's about that healthy relation, one-to-one relationship. But if that relationship is not healthy, which, you know, if we go along with what you've said with the statistics, that's probably the case. Where do you even begin? How can you have that conversation that feels impossible to have with someone that you have a poor relationship with?
It is really challenging because when we have a dysregulated, activated nervous system, we are not ready to look each other in the eyes and have a grounded connection. And sometimes the manager doesn't even allow it. And so this is when we have to rely on other parts of the organization to support us or inevitably maybe have to leave. I know for me, I would prefer to try to stand up and try to have a better and a more effective relationship. This is an invitation to your leader to say, hey, I'm actually being buffeted. I'm not feeling psychologically safe. I think there are some psychosocial hazards here in this workplace, are you willing to have a conversation with me about improving it? And then what conversation can start?
Okay. I just want to come to you, Mariah, still staying with this text, because I think it has a lot of interesting stuff in it. If your job is causing you mental health issues, leave, get a different job, not up to your employer to babysit you, leave, you're a liability, just to refresh your memory. From a legal workplace perspective, from the lens of responsibility of employer to employee, can you analyze the contents of that and just tell us what are an employer's responsibility and yeah.
Yeah, so these laws aren't exactly brand new. They've been clarified, but they're not new. Employers have always had a duty of care to ensure a healthy and safe working environment to their employees. So yes, that duty of care has always existed. It's just now that we have the clarification that health and safety includes mental and psychological health and safety, as well as physical health and safety.
Andrew, how is, I suppose, mental distress from work showing up in your clients at the moment?
It's so common to have an experience in front of me where someone's well-being and health is being dramatically affected by work. And it shows up, I think, in many ways, because what we need at work is care-based leadership. We need the care that we always needed in our lives. Back when we were kids, we needed care, right? Some of us got that, some of us didn't, in buckets. But what we need at work is a caring manager. And when that isn't in place, we can only go towards fear. We can only contract inside of ourselves and withdraw. And it actually cuts us off from other relationships. We start venting in our workplaces versus directing our energy where it's needed for change. And so this can lead to many different problems, both physically and emotionally for people. Anxiety actually creates a lot of challenges in our immune systems and beyond, and it can cause real big problems for people.
Let's take a call now from Angela in Queensland. Angela, you've been off work for 20 months due to a psychological injury. What can you share with us about that experience and what kind of help you're getting?
I am lucky to be well supported. Mine is actually a work cover case where I was in ICU, we had 5 admissions and not enough staff, and I knew I was going to get in trouble. I had confused, combative patient and then another patient, you know, both of them were dying, and I think I texted for help. They call it TMSing for help 5 times, and there was just no one. And the person on the floor is like, I'm sorry, Andrew, you're on your own down there. And so, yeah, I got seriously injured. I had to have cervical spinal surgery. And, as a result, I have PTSD. I had quite a few violence in the workplace incidents before that. So, I've been doing EMDR to kind of get... And then there was lots of complications with my surgery. So, yeah, I've been doing EMDR... And to try and get over the PTSD element. And it really, for me, comes back to chronic staffing in health. I've worked all over Queensland. I've been a nurse for 26 years. And when you're feeling unsafe in the workplace, it's not good. And nurses are burning out and there's so many people leaving in droves. So I'm a member of the union. And one of my friends, he's a member of the union. He was giving an example, I hope you don't mind, of how we could fix it. In New Zealand, they have a nurse on call overnight, and sometimes that night nurse might not get called in, but they get paid like a base rate even if they don't get called in. But if you have someone call in sick, where are you going to get for someone at the last minute, highly skilled as an ICU nurse, to come in? You know, ready for a night, 12-hour night. Mm-hmm. So, you know, things like that, just be prepared for the when we're going to be understaffed. We do our best. They do their best.
Absolutely,
not
Angela.
To. Yeah.
You're there on the front line and it sounds like you got a big psychological injury and also sustained some physical harm as well. Just you offered that example from New Zealand. I wonder if, looking back, the points where you did ask for help and you didn't get supported, if things had turned out differently, where do you think you might be right now if you had gotten that support?
My life would be so much better. Like, I have a little 5-year-old boy with autism. It's been such a struggle. I've got a husband also who also has an injury. Like, it's ruined my life, what I've been through. I get quite upset. Yeah, thinking about it. But luckily I'm a super positive person. I'll fight and fight to be a healthy mum for my little boy. But we've really been struggling because I was the main income earner. So,
That's so hard.
I would love to have never have been hurt.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Angela, thank you so much. And I'm really wishing all the best. I really appreciate you sharing. And I hope that you can, get better as soon as possible.
Thanks.
Andrew, can I come in and invite you in first for a comment on what you heard in Angela's call?
The worst happens to us in this life when we are disconnected from the support we need. And what I heard in Angela's story is that when she needed someone the most, they weren't there. And what Angela has bravely done is consolidate the support she needs to heal and to move beyond this terrible experience. EMDR is a wonderful process for people who have had PTSD
experiences.
Just
explain what the acronym means, please.
You're going to challenge me on this one. It's eye movement desensitization. I forget the R.
Okay, we'll get our wonderful producer back to find out what
we'll
share it soon.
We'll get back to do that. Yes. But it is a neurological process to ease the tension in our nervous systems around these really awful experiences. And it has been proven to really support people who have been through these catastrophic incidents in their lives.
And Mariah, with your, workplace lawyer hat on, what did you hear in Angela's call that were ringing the alarm bells for you?
I think in industries where it's inevitable that staff are going to be exposed to traumatic incidents, such as her working in the ICU, your employer has a higher responsibility to ensure safeguards around that exposure to trauma. So ensuring that she feels supported, the help is there when she needs it, she is listened to, and if she needs a break, there is someone there to cover her. There have been two cases recently. I'm not going to go deep into them because it could be triggering for some people. But both cases involved quite a serious injury. And the cases were very not only expensive for the employers, but both of them were industries where the people were exposed to trauma.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you to Beck. EMDR means eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing.
Reprocessing, great.
And it's an evidence-based psychotherapy designed to help people heal from the emotional distress and symptoms of trauma. So that's what EMDR means. We're talking about new, I guess, strengthened laws across Australia, Mariah, that are specifically looking at safeguarding people's psychosocial safety as equally as our physical safety is protected on the job through all sorts of protections, you know, hard hats, high-vis, all that kind of thing. This is like the high-vis for the mental health, for the soul, for the brain. Let's go to Tim in Nipaluna, Hobart. Welcome to Life Matters, Tim. You've just returned to work after time off due to psychological injury. If you can share, tell us briefly what happened to you and how that was handled by your workplace.
Okay, thank you. I had been in the same job, a public sector job, for 15 years in the same organisation. I developed severe emotional dysregulation in response to certain triggers in the workplace. Eventually it got so bad that I was directed to leave the workplace and go home and go on leave. And I ended up staying on leave for 3 years before returning to work last year. During that time, I had psychotherapy and worked out some medications that worked for me. And the psychotherapy included EMDR, and it was ultimately effective in solving the emotional dysregulation. But it took me 3 years to get back to work.
And Tim, now that you've been back to work, what kind of support have you received? Have you been helped along the way, or have you had to advocate for yourself to get the proper supports?
Look, I was initially put in touch with a support person who was very helpful in putting me in touch with a clinical psychologist. He was somebody who I could talk to and along the way. But it was a very strange process because I was never really told what process I was engaged in. And in the end, I had to fight to get my job back. I've ended up in a different area because my previous area couldn't leave the existing position open for 3 years, obviously. And it's been a tough road to come back. I've had challenges, but I've been working on a combination of medications that have actually, you know, now finally I think helped me get back to being able to operate on, you know, at full capacity.
Tim, you mentioned you were engaged in a process upon your return to work that you didn't really understand or were made aware of. Now, that sounds quite confusing to have lack of clarity in terms of not even knowing what kind of process you're involved in. You know, that can happen in big bureaucratic organizations. I do understand that as well. But, you know, in hindsight, what could have given you more clarity so that you did know what kind of process that you were engaged in from the beginning? What would have helped?
Just my employer actually telling me what, you know, what process I was engaged in, so how they were actually responding and what the sort of framework was, the policy and legal framework around that.
Yeah, that sounds...
Because to this day, almost 4 years later, I'm still not certain what it was that I was involved in.
Mariah, I want to bring you in here because that's quite interesting that an employee can be involved in a process and they don't even know. They really don't even have definitions or parameters. They don't even understand what's going on. And we think, wow, that's bizarre. But actually, I think in the real world, we also know, yeah, that tracks for a lot of workplaces. What are you hearing in what Tim is sharing? And it also strikes me that the process, 3 years and coming back, like that's costly for the employer. That's costly for the employee in many ways. It just seems like a process that is really cumbersome and could be fixed. So tell me your thoughts on that and, you know, give us your mini TED talk on how you think it should be fixed.
I think when Tim was talking, the first thing that I thought of was businesses aren't equipped to have these difficult conversations with staff members. Having a difficult conversation is always going to be inherently hard. No one wants to have them. But Tim was off work for 3 years. you'd think that in that time, or the fact that he went off work because he was unwell and that he stayed on leave, should have been a trigger to the workplace to say, hey, we need to fix what's going on in here. We need to investigate. We need to train our managers. We need to train managers on how to have those difficult conversations so that Tim and everyone else who might be in a similar situation feel supported returning to work.
Mm. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National, and we are talking about how to take care of our psychological safety, our mental health and well-being at work, talking about some of the regulations and laws around that. I am with Andrew Sloan, a psychotherapist who works with individuals and businesses negotiating workplace change, as well as Mariah Lorienti, an employment lawyer and workplace relations consultant. So I want to ask you both about what it's like when you go into workplaces and you're there to help. First question, Mariah, is like, are you on the side of the employer or are you on the side of the employee?
Technically employer.
Yeah.
But I go in because, I mean, when you think about a lawyer, everyone thinks reactive lawyer. There's a mess, lawyer comes in, needs to clean up the mess. The work that we do is a lot more proactive. So we go in and businesses say, we don't want there to be a mess. Help us fix it before it becomes a really big problem.
Okay.
So that's when we go in and we do a really big audit on compliance and culture.
And do you speak just to a certain level of the company or do you try to speak?
Everybody.
You know, okay.
Yeah. So we start at the top and we work our way down. We start with leaders. And I think earlier you would have recalled me saying, leaders say that we've got an open door policy. People can come in and talk about whatever they need to. And then you dig a little bit deeper and you realize that that door is not open.
Yeah.
Or people are too scared to open it because there have been negative ramifications in the past.
I imagine there's trust issues too when you go into workplaces.
Yeah.
And you start to talk to people.
Yeah.
What makes your, how do you get people to open up to you and speak to you honestly, but also what gets your spotty senses tingling when you're hearing things saying, uh-oh, I gotta make a note of that. This is a problem area.
You'd be surprised. People are always more comfortable talking to somebody that they don't know versus their own manager. So I will get the details that their manager has had no information on ever in the past because they consider me like a psychologist. Someone's new, fresh, you know, they're non-biased. They can come in and I can give them that advice and coach them on how to speak to their managers. But it's the conversations that I hear when people say, I'm worried or I'm scared or I've been really stressed out and I haven't raised it because I'm scared of what that means for my job is where I start to think, okay, there are bigger issues here that we need to look into.
Andrew, I want to know what it's like for you when you go into workplaces. First of all, I imagine it's the employer who's hired you, so you're there on the behalf of the employer.
Yeah.
But what are you listening for and how do you engage with workers?
Just this week, I was with an executive team. Just like Mariah said, how we were focused on how do we have difficult and meaningful conversations. The world has never been more brittle, like things are not bending anymore, they're snapping. And so that is leading to a lot of anxiety and anxiousness inside of people. This is making these things even more challenging. And the pace of information, the velocity of our lives is really incomprehensible. So this is all eroding all of the foundations of a great human relationship. So when I walk into the offsite this week, I'm literally having this conversation about what does a regulated nervous system look like in the boardroom, so to speak? What does high trust actually look like? It turns out high trust is authenticity, genuineness. You actually get the real me. Logic. I've backed up my position by data or facts or a part of the systemic process around us. But third, it's care, genuine, compassionate, empathetic care. And a lot of leaders that I've met really struggle with one of those things. They're really direct and they're really logical, but they've got no care. And that disables trust. It breaks the human relationship. So as we're going at a really fast pace, we've got all these activated nervous systems and we don't have that foundation of trust, as you've named, we really break things down. So a lot of my work is to go, okay, well, what's your version of really high trust? What's your version of a meaningful and difficult conversation? And how do we equip you to have that directly with the person? Enough of this venting around the system of work. When we vent, we lose the energy for change inside of that relationship. And so this is how, you know, I'm trying to show up in workplaces.
So I hear what you're saying. I'm just going to be a little bit cynical just for a moment and say, when you work with the executive team only, if that's what you do, I think a lot of people who are not at that executive level probably feel a bit cynical about whether that messaging leaves that boardroom, whether it's a kind of a feel-good exercise for people at the top to make them feel like they've done something.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the kind of people on the lower pay rates, the people who are less empowered, don't necessarily get the real in-the-office place benefits. Things don't get put into action.
There are so many forces away from us doing this. And this is where I kind of turn to the personal responsibility that is echoed in that text that you read earlier, which is, yes, we can wait for our executive team to show up differently, to build higher trust, and that to waterfall down our organizations. But what are we going to do to transform our relationship with work? Mm-hmm. And I think there's both waiting for the system of work to change, as Mariah has been discussing, and then how do we change the culture of work just around us? And this takes personal responsibility and a focus.
Speaking of, before we go to a caller, which I'm going to do very soon, there is a text here talking about legislation, and it speaks to, I think, one of our callers earlier who said there wasn't enough backfill for her. And it says, the texter says, it seems to me that really great industrial legislation is needed, which then translates to a workplace that is safe and supportive. This includes enough budget to cover replacement workers when individuals take time away from work to regulate and heal. Are there laws in place that mandate budgeting to provide backfill support or fill-in support? Or how do you see that? Or do you suggest that in workplaces, you know, as part of your plans for them?
No, there aren't any laws in place that mandate that. And I think that a lot of the time people hear, I mean, employers hear about this new legislation and they think, oh, this is going to be expensive. But I always have to coach them to get out of that mindset and think, well, imagine how expensive it's going to be if you actually start getting some claims through the door. So you need to be doing the front work now and getting on the front foot. So no, there aren't any laws. Yes, there should be. I would have thought that some of the legislation, when it was in its draft form, for example, in Victoria, they were going to mandate having a psychological safety prevention plan, and they were also going to mandate reporting to WorkSafe for any psychological injuries. That was actually taken out of the legislation when it was passed. Things like that force organisations to do more than what they're doing now.
Okay. Let's go to Anthony in New South Wales. Anthony, you left work 2 years ago. What happened?
Yeah, hi, Bev. I worked at a university. I was employed to fill a position from outside the university sector. They created two positions, and the other one was filled by someone from within the university. And it was a pretty steep learning curve for me, not having worked in that sector before. But my colleague refused to sort of help in any way. You know, if I asked a question, it'd be like, well, I had to work that out, so you can work that out for yourself. And just when you're in a completely new environment and with a lot of complexities, it was just really off-putting and, difficult to work with that person. But I sort of rose above it, worked out my own way. But this continued. I worked in that position for 15 years alongside this person, and it was... It was just sort of death by a thousand cuts,
Anthony,
attitude.
What was the... Yep. Tell me about how that affected your well-being.
Well, I thought... Initially, I thought, look, I'm a... This person was 15 years younger than me and had worked at this institution all their lives, and I'd had lots of other jobs in a whole heap of different sectors. So I had quite a bit of life experience, and I thought, you know, I've dealt with difficult people before. I can rise above this. I've got... So that was my attitude, and this will get better, and, you know, what doesn't sort of, you know, kill you makes you stronger. But it just wore me down after years. But luckily our manager was very supportive and realised that there, you know, understood that there was a situation, said, look, I fully support you. I will talk to this person, which she did, and you know, things would improve a little bit, but then it'd go downhill again. But it came to a head. Firstly, COVID, I found COVID a really difficult period. I was isolated working from home. The isolation I felt in the office was just kind of amplified. And then once we got back to work, there were some people had left, and my colleague was then promoted into a position where she became my manager, and it rapidly went downhill from there. Mm. So, you know, the little snipes and comments and, you know, work it outs were, yeah, just completely amplified. And I was just so deep in a rut. I had to seek, you know, counselling, I saw a psychotherapist and, you know, was prescribed. I was in a deep depression and basically burned out.
So
and,
where are you now, Anthony? Are you no longer there?
Yeah, look, I just wanted to make a quick comment on that texter who said, you know, get out, don't, you know, if it's not working for you, get out of the industry, you know, get a new job, basically. You know, your employer's not there to mollycoddle you. In my situation in a regional centre, you know, there wasn't a whole heap of choices, and especially, you know, not... it was a really good job, you know, with great conditions, and my whole life, financial life, was built around... So it's not just as easy as, oh, yeah, you know, I'll go and get another job, which possibly is a, you know, an avenue in a city. But, yeah, so I just wanted to comment on that. But, yeah, look, I was in a deep, deep rut. I just was feeling just completely frozen. But my psychologist really helped me get over that and get through it. And I'm now working in a completely different sector. I'm actually at the coalface in a caring role. Working with youth, and it's just given me a whole new perspective. I just feel so much more useful, and because I was feeling very unuseful and hopeless, and I was questioning my own ability and my... It was pretty terrible, the effect that it had on me.
Anthony, I really appreciate you sharing. That sounds like it was really hard, but it's also really heartening to hear the changes that have happened and that you are in a better place now. Andrew, what's your comment on that call?
The number one thing we need at work is clarity around what good and great looks like. And it seems like Anthony really didn't have that clarity. He didn't have the second thing, which is really great social connection at work. And these are covered in the psychosocial hazards, but they're things that managers and leaders must be tending to around us. Clarity around what great looks like, making sure there's higher trust relationships throughout the team. It sounds like Anthony's manager did support some of that. But yeah, these are integral needs at work. The reason why we struggle is because these are the very foundational needs that we need addressed.
Mariah, I just can't help but wonder, but how different would workplaces be if managers were trained how to be good people managers rather than promoted because they were good at a task or a particular output?
This might get me out of a job. It's 90% of the work I do is talking to managers about how to be a good manager. And 9 times out of 10, they've been accelerated into that role because they are technically competent at what they do. You know, they're a really good accountant, they're a really good lawyer, whatever it is. They go into a management position and then they sit there and they think, well, how do I be a good manager now? How do I excel in this new position? And there's no training around that. But with Anthony's call, what really sparked my attention was this is not just a management problem. This is everybody's responsibility.
Oh, yeah.
His manager was supportive, but it's the relationships around you that also need to be supportive to help foster that good culture.
Mm.
This is really important because I think sometimes we put the pressure on the manager, and it is. 70% of our success at work is our manager. But it is everyone's responsibility to create a well workplace and a workplace that has higher trust and better relationships in it. And so when I walk into a workplace, I'm thinking about that 360-degree effect. Everyone is responsible for making this a better workplace at the end of the day.
Right. Yes. I mean, I hear you, but I'm also empathizing with the people out there listening who are like, I'm trying to do the right thing and the 360 around me is not listening to me. And
totally.
That can be so frustrating and so disheartening. Let's try to sneak in one more call. I'm going to go to Kate in Brisbane. You were in a university where a manager was an expert in HR. So what happened?
I had a series of personal traumatic experiences that meant I needed to take leave. And when I told my manager that I needed to take leave, he demanded to know the details of my personal experience. And I declined to share those, which led him to doubt the legitimacy of my need for leave. And all of the correspondence then became about me not being somehow genuine, and him trying to get me to cover his butt. and no expression of care. And it just went on and on that somehow I was not legitimate.
And this is, I see from my note, the manager was expert in HR. So
yeah,
it's an interesting note that is in there. So what is your comment on that?
Well, I just heard the conversation heading in the direction of training managers.
Yeah.
And I just felt it was really ironic that someone who's supposedly an expert in HR had no people skills.
Yeah.
And even though they know the theory of HR, actually what that led to, as I said, was he wrote me an email that sort of said, I hope you think I'm trustworthy and I'm just trying to do the right thing for you. And it was kind of a butt covering email for him. So I think he knew the law of sort of responsibility or, him needing to be seen to be doing the right thing. But meanwhile, he said to me explicitly when I refused to disclose the details, he said, well, I'll find out anyway when you fill in the leave form.
Okay.
And I had to go to our HR team to confirm whether or not I was obliged to disclose the details. And they told me I wasn't.
Yes. Okay, Kate, thank you very much for sharing that. We are a little bit over time, so we're going to have to close this out. Mariah, can I come to you for the last word? If people are listening and they want more resources or help on how to figure out, assess their psychosocial safety at work, they're hearing our conversation, hearing some alarm bells, what can they do next? Where can you point them to?
I always say go internal, don't go external. Internal might not be the best help, but that's how you know if you're going to get any help at all. Speak to HR, speak to your OH&S rep, speak to your manager, speak to the CEO, whoever it might be. Keep a paper trail of all your conversations. I know it's a very lawyer thing to say, but the more evidence that you can build up will help you if you do need to go external. But I always tell people, try to work it out within yourselves before you, take it to a lawyer or a regulator.
Okay, thank you so much. Mariah Lorienti is an employment lawyer and workplace relations consultant. Andrew Sloan is a psychotherapist who works with individuals and businesses negotiating workplace change. He's also an author. Next up, when does a clothing swap become a clothing shop? The aunties decide.
Hi, I'm Zan Rowe, back on your telly, finding out which five songs mean the world to some amazing people.
And you just go with it.
Like Shania Twain, David Byrne, Jacinda Ardern and Genesis Owusu.
Music is my high.
And if you want to go even deeper, you'll find that on the Take 5 podcast.
Please dance, you can dance.
The new season of Take 5 with me, Zan Rowe. Search Take 5 podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Does a free bag of clothes ever come with strings attached? Only the aunties can decide, so let's ask them. Welcome to our aunties for this week, writer, actor and author Fiona Harris and writer and comedian Jennifer Wong from Chopsticks or Fork on ABC iView. Fiona, I want to start with you. Do you like a bit of op-shop shopping? What's your clothing shopping style?
I hate shopping. I'm just going to say it at the top. So I'm terrible at shopping. I get overwhelmed. There's way too many choices. Op shops, I would probably prefer because there's more. And my daughter is a mad op shopper and she's taught me a few things over
good.
The years.
Oh, good. You've got a stylist on hand.
So if I was going to go shopping, which I would rather not, it would be op shops.
Jen, what about you?
I actually find it very hard to find things that fit me anywhere. And so I think I don't really shop at op shops for clothes. I go to op shops to look at knickknacks and look at what's in the window.
Okay. So more of an online shopper then?
Oh, more of a let's delay it to the last minute possible and then freak out
same.
When there's an event okay. on and kind of go, what is around? Help me,
fair,
someone.
Fair. I could relate to that as well. Okay, let's see how we can help Suzanne with a wardrobe quandary. Let's get into it. She writes, I have a friend who has fantastic style. We often shop together and exchange outfit picks. But this friend goes through clothes a lot faster than I do. She's always flush with cash and has enough to drop on a complete wardrobe refresh every 6 months. Fiona, if you had a friend like Suzanne's friend and you went shopping with her, how would that make you feel?
I do have a friend like that.
Okay.
Exactly like this. And she often, not often, maybe once a year takes me shopping because she knows I hate it. I love it because she knows what she's doing and she is flush with cash. I am not.
Does she pay too?
No, oh. But we organise it. We have a lot of advance time to work out my savings and then we go.
Okay, that sounds fun. Jen, this dynamic, one friend is flush with cash, the other less, let's infer less so because she's actually mentioning as a thing. Can it be tricky when friends have different incomes or spending habits?
Oh, for sure. I am also in this situation. And I think it's great. You know, they can spend their money and I can kind of tag along and imagine what it would be like to be like that. Also, mm-hmm. I wonder if Suzanne's friend is available to help me shop. I have some events coming up. If she has fantastic style, I'm open to some pointers.
So let's move on to the second chapter from Suzanne. So Suzanne writes, in a nice turn of events, on my friend's last wardrobe cleanout, she gifted me the lot. It was very generous, and there were tons of great items that are now my faves. There are also quite a few that just aren't my style. Often when I'm done with clothes, I sell them online and buy some new pieces with the proceeds. She's gifted me some pretty expensive stuff that I don't wear, and it's designer. So can I make a buck off my friend's gift to me, or is that weird? Jennifer, I'm coming to you. What do you think of Suzanne's situation? If you got handed this big treasure trove of clothes and you couldn't keep some, would this cross your mind as well?
In order to make some money, well, I think, well, like a good friend will give you the shirt off their own back, right? This is actually what's happened now. And I think once someone gives you a gift, I think that you can do whatever you want with it, especially because the friend seems to be going through these clothes a lot. Like, they're not sentimental to her, right, if they've been given to her. So I think if the writer, Suzanne, needs some money, I think her friend might understand, sure, go for it. I don't need them anyway. They're yours. Do what you like.
That's a pretty straightforward answer from Jen. Fiona, do you see it the same or differently?
No, I kind of see it very differently, only because this is a very foreign concept to me and a world to me. I wouldn't even know where to begin looking online to resell things or to buy things.
Oh,
I'm just not
apps.
An online shopper. Yeah. I have no apps. So for me, it's a very foreign concept anyway. But I don't know. I think I feel a bit weird about the whole idea of making money off something I've been gifted, even if it's a friend who, you know, I think Jennifer's right. Obviously, it wouldn't matter to her, but I think I would just feel weird about that. So if anything, I'd give them away to someone who I know would like that
taste. Okay, so you will pass them on, but you don't think that there's any monetary benefit to be had?
There is monetary benefit to be had. I just don't know that I would personally do that.
With the income differential, put yourself in Suzanne's shoes.
Yeah, I am. I don't know what it is. I just feel a bit icky about that.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Okay, let us now continue on. So let's see how Suzanne is handling this. Suzanne writes, I guess I'm hesitating because I could use the cash, and something about asking her permission seems a little embarrassing. Mm. But I don't want her to find her old clothes suddenly popping up on the vintage resale sites I use. If I don't resell them, they're just going to the op shop anyway, or worse, landfill. So what do I do with these mint condition designer clothes that have landed in my lap? Okay, Jen, I want you to come in and pick this apart a little bit, please, because you are in favor of Suzanne reselling the clothes. Suzanne's sticking point is asking about permission, which seems a little embarrassing. To me, that speaks a bit to a pre-existing friendship dynamic. What do you think?
Yeah, I think actually suddenly it's not so much about the items of clothing anymore and where they'll go and how they'll be sold, but it's about whether or not you feel comfortable letting your friend know either that you're having some situations where you could do with a little bit more money, and probably that's a lot of us right now, to be honest, but, you know, being open about that, a situation that the friend would have perhaps no idea what that's like because she's spending so much shopping regularly, right? So there's that. But I think the other thing is like she doesn't want her friend to find the clothes suddenly on a vintage resale site. And I kind of think like, well, the chances of that happening are pretty slim, to be honest. Like these are not one-off items. These are items that exist, and I don't think the friend is going to be on a vintage resale site looking for them. I think the only thing that would kind of be different is if the items have sentimental value. You know, if it's something like my mum made this, it doesn't fit me anymore, it's you know, everyone in every person in our family who can fit it has worn it. I would love you to have it because I know it would fit you. It would mean so much to me if you kept it and this item could continue to be worn. And if she sold that, that would be a bit different. But this friend is shopping all the time. You know, it's I think she should just talk to her friend and be upfront.
Yeah, fair enough. I do think it is sometimes possible to see what a seller, like what else they're selling. So I'm not saying that the friend is going to go through the app. But if they were to and they think, oh, that looks like that looks like my handbag. And they're like, oh, who else is selling this? Oh, that looks like my trench coat. Yeah. Oh, that looks like my pair of boots. That would be a funny conversation to have. I guess it depends on, the strength of the friendship, Fiona, that dynamic I was speaking to. What's your take on Suzanne thinking it's embarrassing to ask her friend for permission? There's two bits to that, asking for permission, but also being embarrassed by that.
Yeah, I think, look, personally, I would just decide in the end. It's all too much stress. I mean, you just don't want to be worrying about her seeing them on the site. You don't want to be stressing about having this embarrassing conversation. Like, just pay it forward. Just give those clothes to a friend. If you don't want to give them to the op shop or you're worried about landfill, surely there's someone in your life, your mum or a friend or an auntie or someone who will wear those clothes. Just get rid of them and don't have to deal with the mental stress that might come with the other option.
I have a volunteer auntie coming in on the text line with this suggestion. So auntie is here with me on air. Please weigh in on this solution. Sell, but give the friend 50-50, but advise you would do first, sell it first with their permission. What do you think of that solution, Fiona?
Yeah, actually, that's another good option, I think. I think being upfront, because it's not worth the worry that you're going to have every time you see that friend or you get a text from her like, oh, has she seen it? Has she seen it online? I think that's a great suggestion.
I think Suzanne is asking us for permission to sell the clothes online. That's why I think Suzanne, because otherwise, you know, why ask, right? So, yeah. Jen, let's say we're going to help facilitate Suzanne selling the clothes online and she wants to have this conversation because it is embarrassing. How do you, you're an advocate of that. How do you have that conversation? Help Suzanne find the words.
I'd be like, hey, friend. Would you mind if I, you know, those clothes you don't want? Would you mind if I put them up on whatever and
I imagine the friend is now like looking down at the floor and kicking the dirt with their boot the way. Like, does it have to be in person? Can it be text?
You wouldn't mind. Would you like, they're not like, I'm super grateful that you give me this stuff, but this particular thing's not going to like work with what I'm wearing. Do you mind if I sell it? Like,
Yeah. Okay.
Sounds like a very nervous conversation.
How is that helpful?
All right.
Am I using the right words? I think I use all the words.
Good luck to you, Suzanne. Take Jennifer Wong's skeleton and build on that. We've got faith in you. Jennifer Wong's book is called Chopsticks or Fork, just like her ABC iView series. You can catch Jen live at Sydney Fringe in September. She's hosting a chat show about Indian home cooking called Feast Chat Show Edition. If you get the pun, good on you. Extra points. Head online to the Sydney Fringe website for tickets. Fiona Harris is a writer and actor. Her latest book is called The Embarrassing Confessions of Gracie Sparks and The Rebound. That's two books. If you have a dilemma that needs the auntie's help, please write to us. The email address is lifematters@abc.net.au. That's lifematters@abc.net.au. And a big thank you to Life Matters producers who bring you all the stories and interviews you hear across the week. They are Jack McDonald, Bronwyn O'Shea, Lucy Sweeney, Beck Zajac, and our acting executive producer, Grace Pashley. The audio engineer is Elise Simons, and you can find all of Life Matters episodes on ABC Listen. Search for Life Matters, tap the heart to follow. You're all set. I'm Beverly Wang. Thank you so much for all your calls and messages. Let's talk again next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.